You're listening to a Toronto Centre podcast. Welcome. The goal of TC Podcasts is to spread the knowledge and accumulated experience of global leaders, experts, and world-renowned specialists in financial supervision and regulation. In each episode, we'll delve into some of today's most pressing issues as it relates to financial supervision and regulation. The financial crisis, climate change, financial inclusion, fintech, and much more. Enjoy this episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Toronto Centre's event on the Nexus of Financial Inclusion, Resilience and Supervision, which we are conducting as part of Canada's International Development Week. I am the President and CEO of the Toronto Centre. The IDW is a moment to reflect on how strong inclusive financial systems support broader development goals from poverty reduction and gender equality to sustainable economic growth. I'm delighted that we have more than 320 participants at this webinar representing 78 countries and more than 40 agencies. While the World Bank's Global Findex 2025 shows that real progress has been made globally in access to financial products, the data also reminds us that access alone is not enough. A sustained effort is still required to improve financial health and well-being, particularly for women and other vulnerable groups. This is where effective regulation and supervision truly matter. National regulators and supervisors working alongside the public and private sectors play a critical role in building trust, resilience, and confidence in financial systems. In today's environment of trade diversification, which is so important for Canada and many other countries, and increasingly complex cross-border value chains, effective supervision also plays a quiet but essential role in enabling trade itself. It underpins trust that payments will clear, institutions will remain sound, and financial links between countries will hold even under stress. Since our inception in 1998, Toronto Centre has trained over 32,000 financial supervisors from 190 countries and territories, helping to strengthen more stable, inclusive, and resilient financial systems worldwide. This mission would not be possible without the generous support of Global Affairs Canada, Swedish CETA, the IMF, and other valued partners. Today, our distinguished panels will share their practical experiences on how supervisors are advancing inclusion while fostering stability and resilience. We are especially pleased to feature an all-women panel of senior leaders bringing diverse regional perspectives to this important conversation. Our panelists are Leona Clapper, lead economist at the World Bank and co-author of Global Findex 2025. Mariela Zaldivar, head of market conduct and financial inclusion as a supervisory institution of Peru. And Rodora Brasil de Vera, not from Brazil, but she's the officer in charge of supervisory policy and research at the Central Bank of the Philippines. The discussion will be moderated by our good friend, Lindsay Wallace, Executive Director of FINCA Canada and Managing Director for Social Investment Strategies and FINCA International. Lindsay, I think this is the third job of yours that I've been tracking you. Before we begin, a quick housekeeping note. This session will be conducted in English with simultaneous interpretation available in French and Spanish. We also encourage you to use the Q&A function to make this an interactive discussion, and I look forward to hearing your questions. With that, before I hand over to Lindsay, I'm very pleased to introduce Barbara Curran, special guest, Director General at Global Affairs Canada, where she drives international assistance partnerships across education, gender equality, human rights, governance, and economic growth. Barbara, is there anything else left? Bring in more than 25 years of senior public service leadership to Canada's work on the global stage, and doing so as a genuinely generous and thoughtful person. We are deeply grateful to Global Affairs Canada for its continued support and to Barbara for joining us today. Barbara, we're all eager to hear from you. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you very much. A very warm greeting To all participants, panelists, and colleagues from around the world joining this important webinar today, I understand that over 300 individuals are going to be joining us. How fantastic is that? I hadn't realized it was an all-women panel until you mentioned it, Babak, and that even makes it extra special for me in terms of our gender equality efforts that are consistent and required. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that I'm speaking from Ottawa, Canada, on traditional and unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe people. And I appreciate greatly that the Toronto Centre is hosting this important event during International Development Week, which is a very important week for all development practitioners. And I'm so pleased to be here today celebrating that with you. I want to say right away that we are deeply appreciative of the partnership we have with the Toronto Centre and the world-class work they do. Babak, don't blush. I just want to make sure I say that right up front before I get into some of my more general remarks. International Development Week, for those who have not heard of it before, for Canada, it's a time we celebrate partnership and also practical action to reduce poverty, advance equality, and create opportunities around the world. And this global panel is so indicative of all of those elements. So I'm very honored to be here today with our distinguished panelists and with all of you, and applaud your efforts to make financial services work for everyone. I'm going to say share some thoughts, and in some ways I feel like, well, of course all of you know this, but it's worth underscoring that financial stability and inclusion matters because it gives people real choices. When financial systems are sound and someone has a safe place to save, a reliable way to send money, or access to relevant and appropriate financial services, they can plan for the future. This makes communities stronger and more resilient. However, and this is some of the conversation that I think the panelists and others will get into, access alone does not guarantee better lives. Services must be easy to use, fair, adapted, and trusted. New tools, whether it be here for us or elsewhere in the world, need to be developed to reach people in rural and remote places and reach those who have been left out for far too long. So I'm very excited to hear about the inclusion elements that will be discussed today. Listening to the people who use these services and designing solutions that meet their needs is absolutely key. Given the breadth of the conversation and the partnerships that we have at the table today, or the virtual table as it may be, it's important that countries and financial institutions share ideas and experiences in strengthening financial sector resilience, which will be critical to create a stable investment climate. This is especially true along economic corridors where trade and movement of goods and people are growing. That growth supports jobs and opportunities in a variety of sectors, in agriculture, in micro, small, and medium enterprises, in manufacturing, in retail, and in other sectors where economic development can emerge. It goes without saying, but when farmers have access to savings and simple credit, they can invest in seeds and tools, for example. When small shop owners use reliable payment systems, they can reach more customers. When manufacturers can access finance, they can expand and hire more people. These are practical ways that inclusion and stability support real economic progress. With humility, I share that Canada brings significant experience to this work. The Bank of Canada is well regarded for steady stewardship. Our provincial and national regulatory authorities work to protect consumers and to keep markets fair. That credibility helps Canada's and its partners, like the Toronto Centre, share lessons and support local solutions to challenging issues. Babak alluded to this, and the world is changing fast. Climate-related shocks are testing household and business resilience. Digital technology and artificial intelligence are changing how people decide, save, pay, borrow. Trade patterns and supply chains are shifting. These trends create both risks and opportunities for financial systems. They make it more important than ever to work together to design inclusive digital services that protect users and build rules that are flexible and forward-looking. Canada has long been supporting efforts that strengthen local capacity, encourage responsible innovation, and protect the most vulnerable. We importantly know that no one single actor can solve these challenges alone. Progress comes when governments, supervisors, service providers, civil society, and communities work together. What we have here today is you are the experts and have a wealth of knowledge and experience. How supervisors and regulators encourage services that are simple and safe, about how providers reach people who live far away from banks and reliable internet, and how cooperation with each other supports investments and trade, and how that cooperation meets more sectors and more people. I'm sure the conversations are going to be great today. I invite us to keep the human story at the center of our work. Success can be measured in many ways. There's no doubt about that. I would suggest none better than lives improved. I want to thank all of you again, and a special shout out to the Toronto Centre and the panelists for your forthcoming insights. And for bringing us together to discuss this important topic. Thank you for giving me the floor and being so generous with your time.
Thank you very much, Barbara. There are two quotable moments from you. One is success is measured in lives improved and all the wonderful things you said about Toronto Centre. Thank you so much. And with that, I'll hand it over to Lindsay. Go ahead, Lindsay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Babak and Barbara, and a big thank you to the Toronto Centre for giving me the opportunity to moderate this panel. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Lindsay Wallace. I'm the Executive Director of Finca Canada. And at Finca, we provide financial services to medium, small, and micro enterprises in 13 countries. And we also support clients through our investment portfolio that focuses on innovative social enterprises. I'm also the board chair of the Canada Forum for Impact Investment and Development, a network of over 130 organizations and individuals working to increase Canadian impact-focused investing into emerging markets. And we're honored to have both Toronto Centre as well as Global Affairs Canada as a member. This year, as was mentioned, for International Development Week, the theme is Prosperity Through Partnership. And with our excellent panelists, we hope to explore this theme today in a conversation about the intersection of financial inclusion, financial resilience, and financial supervision. As mentioned, we have well over 300 registrants in over 78 countries. So welcome to everybody. I've been watching the chat, and it's so exciting to see everybody from around the world. So please continue to identify yourselves in the chat and where you're dialing in from. There will be a Q&A at the end of the session, but I thought it'd be helpful first to just talk a little bit about what do we mean by financial resilience. And broadly, it's the financial resilience is really the capacity to withstand income or asset shocks without sacrificing your well-being. It's the source, the etymology of the word is from the Latin word resilio, which means to bounce back. And for those of us here in Canada, it is a term that our Prime Minister likes to use regularly. And we have a big focus on making sure that we're all resilient, and financial resilience is a critical component of that. We know that financial resilience can be enhanced using appropriate savings, credit, payment, and insurance products that are both affordable, accessible, and adaptable for both households and firms to allow them to deal with shocks, address changing incomes, or provide a cushion through their savings. And the need for greater financial resilience is very much linked to the types of shocks and challenges that low-income households in particular and businesses face. We know the agriculture sector and smallholder farmers are subject to significant risks in many countries, and that other countries as well face risks from natural disasters. And finally, we know that health-related shocks are often the reason that many households are not able to emerge out of poverty on a permanent basis. So the big question I think we have is, how do we leverage financial tools to increase resilience, particularly for the most vulnerable? And as Barbara mentioned, digitization is becoming an important element of ensuring resilience by reducing the time and increasing the access of to financial tools through greater digital savings, digital credit, and even innovations in digital insurance, as well as payments. But what do we know really about the level of financial resilience globally, particularly for those who are the most vulnerable? And importantly, what role should financial sector supervisors and regulators play in enhancing resilience? Is there a trade-off between enhancing financial resilience without undermining financial sector stability? And so these are some of the issues we're going to explore a little bit today with our great panel. I'm first going to turn to Leora Clapper of the World Bank to tell us a few facts. The last FinDex, I think, it was the fifth round of FinDex. And as most of you will know, the FinDex is a global survey looking at a variety of issues in financial inclusion. So, Leora, how does the Global FinDex for 2025 assess financial resilience? And please share with us your views on financial resilience for different financial services sectors and some of the indicators that you've found.
Thank you, and thank you for the opening remarks as well. And I appreciate the Toronto Centre convening this really interesting and excellent, I think, timely panel. So let me start by setting the scene for attention that we're seeing in the Global FinDex 2025 data. So by many measures, there's been real progress in financial inclusion. So in low and middle income countries, about 75% of adults now have an account. That's an 80% increase since we started collecting the data in 2011. So usage has grown too. About 40% of adults report saving formally, and roughly 80% of account owners make or receive digital payments, which are safer and more transparent than cash. But here's the challenge. This growth in account ownership and usage hasn't translated into stronger financial health. As was just said in the opening remarks, the goal of financial inclusion is to improve people's financial well-being. And so, for example, only 56% of adults say that they can come up with extra money within 30 days to cover some unexpected shock, like a medical expense. And that figure hasn't budged since 2017. So the question I want to pose is, does this matter for regulators? And to be clear, I'm not suggesting that central banks should take on all the responsibilities of improving financial health, although I look forward to hearing from my co-panelists. But I will suggest that weak financial health can weaken the use of formal financial channels, which can have implications for the effectiveness of monetary channels. Let me share my screen. I'm going to share an infographic from the Global FinDex report, which I encourage you to visit, globalfindex.worldbank.org. Can you see my screen? Okay.
Yes, we can.
So Global FinDex 2025 touches on each of the commonly used four dimensions of financial health. So first, let's start with financial security. So this is about whether people can meet day-to-day expenses and longer-term obligations without constant stress. So in sub-Saharan Africa, about one in five adults say their biggest financial worry is paying their kids' school fees. In South Asia, one in four adults borrow for medical expenses, but most depend on informal lenders and family and friends. In Nigeria, almost one in five adults borrow for a business, but almost all do so informally. And so why does this matter for regulators? Because its persistent insecurity can push people towards informal markets and can ultimately undermine the kind of inclusive growth that supports macro financial stability. Second, looking at financial resilience, this is the ability to cope with and recover from shocks. Some indicators are subjective, but others are very concrete. So exposure to extreme weather events, for example, is high in places like the Dominican Republic, the Philippines, Morocco, in low-income countries such as Mozambique and Madagascar, and I'm sure it's salient for many other participants from Barbados and elsewhere. And the recovery depends on savings, insurance, access to credit, social safety nets, and for millions of households, international remittances. And regulators should care because low resilience amplifies systemic vulnerabilities and can transmit climate and disaster risks into liquidity and solvency pressure for financial providers. Third, we think about financial control. This is the ability to manage transactions accurately and avoid costly mistakes. So about one in five adults receiving private wage payments report paying higher fees than expected. Over time, this might be both a signal of weak financial disclosure and transparency. And over time, this can erode trust, discourage meaningful usage of financial services, that can create hidden costs and disputes that can complicate supervision and consumer protection. And finally, we think about autonomy. And this is how digital access can increase independence in managing finances without having to depend on a husband or other family members to do it for you. And so there are real-time tools that allow people to check their balances, review transactions, and spot errors or fraud quickly. Yet fewer than half of adults with an account actually use digital tools to manage their balances. And why does this matter? Because it leaves users more exposed to fraud and misuse and will weaken their use of formal financial products. So the takeaway for regulators is that inclusion gains are necessary, but they're not sufficient. If we want access to translate into real financial health, we need well-designed products, strong and enforced consumer protection so that consumers trust and will use formal financial channels. Thank you.
Thank you so much for setting the scene for us there, Leora. And I completely agree. Inclusion is necessary but not sufficient. So it's with great pleasure I'm going to ask some questions of our supervisors, starting first with Mariella. Now, Mariella, you've been at the forefront of advancing financial inclusion in Peru, having led on the past few financial inclusion strategies. And how does your supervisory mandate in Peru address financial inclusion and resilience?
Okay. Good morning, everybody. First, the Superintendent of Insurance and Private Pension Funds is the financial, insurance, private pension, credit cooperative, regulator and supervisor, market conduct, prudential, as well as we have the financial intelligence unit. So we have quite a lot of information here to deal with this. For us, the SBS, financial inclusion is a key enabler for stability and resilience. Actually, even though our core mandates are focused on the soundness, stability, and integrity of financial markets, we include financial inclusion as part of one of the most important strategic objectives. We consider a broader, safer, transparent financial system not only contribute for financial stability, but also strengthen a household's confidence and ability to manage risk and withstand shocks. Actually, we have a permanent deal, have to deal with the balance between stability, integrity, protection, and inclusion. At a national level, just considering that the markets are currently more complex and we have to articulate and coordinate with other important stakeholders, the SBS plays a leading and coordinating role in Peru financial inclusion agenda. Actually, since 2014, Peru is an active member of the Multisectoral Commission for Financial Inclusion. That is the main interagency platform for aligning financial inclusion policies. It was in charge of the design of our two strategies, one in 2015, the second one in 2019, and is composed by 10 public institutions, seven ministries. Since 2019, the SBS is the technical secretariat of this multisectoral commission, giving the commission not only continuity but also stability, and give technical assistance to the different members. We are the ones that are in charge of the monitor and evaluation system for the national policy. We also have to perform impact assessments and provides data of the progress on financial inclusion in the country, because we have information for different sources, supply because of financial providers. But we also perform different surveys just to have a better understanding of people's needs. And we also contribute in the development and design of the national strategies. And we are clear that financial inclusion is not, of course, the main goal. The main goal is financial well-being, and financial inclusion is just the mean just to achieve this goal. And for that, we work in five different lines, what we call five priority objectives. The first one is working on confidence, working on financial education in an articulated way. The second one is requiring the financial sector to develop adequate and suitable products that fit people's needs, that take into account user experience, just to create a responsible inclusion and not to create exclusion, but bad practices, for example, and that's why we focus on the third objective on financial consumer protection and financial competition. The third one is focused on expanding telecommunication infrastructure and digital platform to increase coverage and adoption. Without infrastructure, we cannot talk about not digital financial inclusion, but financial inclusion at whole. And the last one, and not the less important, probably the most complicated, is enhancing institutional coordination, policy, and have policy coherence. We have to articulate, even though there are 10 financial institutions that are part of the multisectoral commission, we have to coordinate with other public institutions and private ones. No, and but we have this kind of platform, and we work together, just having a common language and a unique view of what we expected and understanding of financial inclusion.
Thank you so much, Mariella. It's obviously a lot to do with all of the different entities of that you oversee, and I can only imagine some of the competing priorities that come up, which I'm sure many others on the call have also had to deal with. And we can get into some of those tensions and challenges a little bit later. Next, I'm going to turn to Rhodora, Brazil. First of all, I need to say a big thank you to Rhodora because it's very late in the Philippines. So thank you so much for joining us during your evening. And can you just share a little bit about the regulatory approach to financial resilience and financial inclusion in the Philippines? And a little bit specifically about your enhanced regulatory relief policy of the banks at Central Bank of the Philippines?
Okay. Hello. Good morning, afternoon, and good evening, everyone. So thank you for the question, Lindsay. So financial inclusion, sustainability, and resilience, well, these are big concepts, and they are not isolated concepts. They are deeply interconnected. So for regulators, well, wearing my supervisor's hat, connecting these dots is essential to crafting an effective and proportionate policy response. So let me begin with financial inclusion, which is the foundation of everything we aim to achieve. So in the Philippines, we have the National Strategy for Financial Inclusion. So this positions inclusion as a key pathway to inclusive growth and financial resilience, especially for the underserved households and micro and small medium enterprises. We have priority initiatives included in this strategy, such as the promotion of inclusive digital finance, the strengthening of financial education and consumer protection, which was highlighted by Leora earlier. And then we also have one of the initiatives is to enhance agriculture and MSME financing ecosystem. And so as we advance the sustainability and sustainable finance, we must be mindful of any potential unintended consequences on vulnerable sectors. So this is why we refined our earlier BSP's sustainable central banking strategy into the inclusive sustainability agenda. So this ensures that sustainability and climate action are pursued through an inclusion lens. So it is embedded in our 2024 and up to 2029 enterprise-wide strategy and places climate adaptation front and center, given the Philippines' high vulnerability to natural hazards. But we also pursuing mitigation as a co-benefit, but helping communities adopt in an is an urgent priority. So the agenda supports a climate resilient financial system by integrating climate and nature-related risks into the risk management and governance of banks. We also improve access to financing for adaptation and the green transition, and also embedding sustainability in within the internal operations of the BSP as, of course, a demonstration of leadership. So this feed into directly into financial resilience, I think, which was highlighted earlier. So the ability to absorb and absorb the shocks and recover from shocks without compromising your long-term well-being. So while financial resilience sits at the household level, the BSP strengthens this indirectly through our regulations that influence how financial institutions lend, how they manage risk, and ensure that essential financial services remain accessible, especially for the vulnerable groups. But financial resilience depends on the ability of the banking system or the financial system to function during crisis, which brings me to operational resilience, because I think financial resilience is more on the demand side, while the operational resilience is on the supply side, just the finance providers. So in 2024, we issued the guidelines on operational resilience to ensure that banks or and other supervised financial institutions of the BSP can continue or swiftly resume critical services during or after disruptions such as typhoons, floods, cyber incidents, or power and connectivity failures. So in a country like ours, where extreme weather is frequent, strong business continuity is not optional. So it is indeed critical and essential. And also our sustainability-related guidelines also emphasize that climate and environmental risk translate directly into operational risk. So requiring robust governance, conduct of vulnerability assessments and crisis response mechanism. So building on these regulations, we enhance our BSP's regulatory relief policy, which reinforces both financial and operational resilience during calamities. So this updated policy provides, let me just mention some of the relief measures, like the temporary grace periods on loan payments. Of course, this is subject to the mutual or agreement between the bank and the affected borrower. And it also the policy also temporarily excludes affected loans from past due and non-performing classifications. So these measures aims to ease pressure on affected borrowers and prevent abrupt deterioration in the asset quality. But we also have some safeguards to have the financial health of the system in check. And then on the operational side, the policy also relaxes some notification and reporting requirements, for instance, on temporary closures of affected branches of banks. And also adjustment in their banking schedules since they were also affected by the typhoons, for instance. So this gives them the flexibility to focus on immediate service restoration rather than paperwork. And lastly, the policy accounts for liquidity challenges, especially among rural banks, which are located in the countryside. So by allowing temporary flexibility in cash withdrawals from the regional offices of the BSP, so communities continue to have access to cash during emergencies. So through all this, through this regulatory relief policy, we aim to reduce strain, sorry, on financial institution while also protecting the affected clients. So this serves as a bridge between operational resilience, ensuring banks stay functional, and financial resilience, helping households and migrant small medium enterprises regain stability. So ultimately, this reinforces our broader goals of financial inclusion and sustainability. I hope I was able to answer your question. I stop here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I think how you framed it is very helpful. We have financial resilience at the household and the business level. We have financial resilience at the individual financial institution level. And then, of course, you take a macro view as well of how is the whole financial sector and how is it resilient, so that we don't get contagion or some of the other challenges. Yeah, I think that's a very, very helpful framing. So coming back to that household level financial resilience, last week the GSMA came out with a report looking at the role of digital credit as a tool for financial resilience. And it's one of their findings was that it's becoming a really important tool for many to manage short-term cash flow, to smooth consumption and respond to financial shocks. But they also highlighted a number of challenges with this rapid expansion of digital credits and highlighted some of the risks. Lior, just turning to you again, from the 2025 FinDex surveys, what are some of the trends that you may be seeing on digital finance, and if you can say anything on digital credit in particular, and how do you see digital finance intersecting with financial resilience?
So digital credit, I have less information on, but I can certainly be happy to talk more about the risks and opportunities of digital finance. Because one of the things that's new in the 2025 Global FinDex is that for the first time we can look at financial inclusion together with digital connectivity. So we have the new data on who owns a phone, who uses the internet, and how safe people are online. And that's what's really important because mobile money and mobile-enabled app-based accounts are driving account ownership everywhere. In every region, all growth in account ownership is coming through these mobile-enabled accounts. And so the big picture, just first looking at connectivity, which is critical to access any of these digital financial services, is that phone ownership is very high, but actually uneven. So about 85% of adults in low and middle income countries own a phone, but women, poor adults, rural adults are still less likely to be connected and also less likely to have an internet-enabled smartphone. But what we're seeing in the data is this big shift in behavior. So formal saving has increased sharply, but it's driven in a large part by these mobile-enabled accounts. That makes it easier to save, especially small amounts more frequently. Payments are becoming more digital. Government transfers and wages are increasingly being paid into an account. And for many people, that's their first touching point to the formal financial system. At the same time, getting to the credit piece, everyday digital payments to pay for groceries and other purchases is now becoming the norm. And this matters because it creates records that can support both household money management, but also business sales records and potentially access to credit. So, for example, what we're seeing around the world is the introduction of cash flow lending models, which use real-time visibility into firm sales through the digital payments and embedded payments to the lenders to reduce both credit and recourse risk. And this is, could have a tremendous benefit for small businesses who, again, we see in the data are borrowing, but mostly in informal markets. Cash-based flow lending can potentially offer formal credit. Taking it a step further, the adoption of these digital merchant payments might also be a key lever in developing the whole digital ecosystem and building financial resilience. So it's encouraging that more money is arriving digitally from employers, from the government, and more people are keeping their money in their accounts. But people will only keep their money digital if they can use their phone to buy their groceries. Especially if you're the one in four adults who suffered an extreme weather event, if you're afraid you won't be able to reach your bank to withdraw cash after a flood and you won't be able to buy your family food, you're going to hold cash. And so, with this goal of keeping storing money in account can help financial resilience by making it easier to manage your money expenses and smooth consumption when shocks hit. It's again important to look at the complete digital ecosystem.
Thanks, Lyra. And so certainly some definitely a lot of opportunities, a significant growth, but certainly some risks from expanding digitization, and something I know that's very much at the top of mind of our regulators and supervisors. Turning to you, Mariella, just thinking about risk as well. We know that financial crime is a significant risk. And as a supervisory agency, how do you ri address the risk of potentially excluding some people that comes from financial crime or misconduct? And maybe if you could speak a little bit about increasing digital connectivity and how that might also affect those issues.
Okay. I mean, digital financial services, as I have already mentioned, have give us a big opportunity to increase financial inclusion. Actually, when we start, or since we have this explosion here in the country with digital financial services, we increase the financial inclusion in terms of people, adult people with a saving account in more than 25 percentage point. And it was in a very short period of time. Now we jump from around 40% to a two-thirds of population with a saving account or a digital wallet that in the case of Peru are supporting by savings accounts. But it's not just to have access to these products, but also we require quality of the products. In that sense, we are following very closely as regulator how these products are performing in the market. So we can also say that since that moment, in this period of time, 2020, since 2025, the number of complaints related to the number of transactions just fall in around 10 times. So there are more people using their financial services. They are more people using the frequency just also increase the ticket size is going down because there are more poor people that are going into the market and the number of complaints are reducing. So, and this is something we are following permanently. That's why market conduct is one of the institutional mandates here in the country. We improve regulation aligned with standards, international standards and best practices, establishing minimum requirements for governance, internal process, organizational structure. We also require standards in the design of products, effective complaint handling, transparency, etc. But we also improve, and maybe this is something we just move very fast, it's supervision. We're using artificial intelligence and analyzing a high a volume of data, structured and not structured data, so that we can just see what's happening in the market in real time. We see what people are saying in social media every moment, and we analyze all the information supply and demand side data to see how the market is performing. And it was very helpful, and that was why we just can see that complaint that there are not frauds. Even every time we see a problem in the market, we not just coordinate with institutions, the financial providers, but also with other public institutions like the Consumer Protection Agency, for example, or the telco regulator, to see and solve the problems that start to appear in the market. But we were also on financial education issues because, I mean, it's a key preventive role, strengthening consumer ability to understand, assess, and appropriate use of financial services help to keep the market soundness and safe. No, that's why we coordinate, for example, with the Ministry of Education, and is currently in the curriculum, the school curricula. Since 6 years old, people are receiving financial education at schools, and also how to use technology in a safe way. We just perform educational campaigns using social media, etc. Perform some financial education programs and workshops. And something that maybe is very important is that we measure all the actions we have performed in the market for supervision, for regulation, market conduct, and financial education. That's why we are performing next month, we are performing the first national financial capability survey that not only measure financial education in terms of knowledge, attitudes, behaviors, but also we measure resilience and financial health. No, and I can say the last survey performed in December 2025, in what we wanted to see is how is working or the perception of people and also other stakeholders in this more complex digital financial ecosystem. And what we saw is that even though people are using the digital financial services and are an opportunity to be benefit for be part of this financial sector, we can still see that between 15% and 20% of Peruvian people feels still insecure using these financial services, no? Mainly because of transaction failures or interruptions, no? And we see also that there are still important gaps in terms of digital financial education. Even though people don't share their password, they are still storing them in their devices or using public networks when they are doing financial transactions, no? And something that we are seeing and we have to work on that is that almost 50% of Peruvian population are exposed to frauds. And almost one of five have already experienced financial losses. So that's why we have to work and coordinate with many different actors, because not all the responsibilities are currently on financial sector, or not all the responsibilities are focused on people. There are other actors now. The cyber crimes are growing up very fast, and that's why we, as regulator, work very hard on cybersecurity, considering as a critical role in protecting integrity of financial system. We regulate and supervise them, and clearly define responsibilities, because financial institutions cannot just put responsibilities on people that in some cases they have to keep them. And of course, the most again, the last line of actions we have is the coordination mechanism. We have to coordinate with many different, with policy, with a telco regulator, central bank, consumer protection agencies, and many others, because there are a very, very complex ecosystem currently with digital financial services. I stop here.
Thank you very much. That is very complex. And I think actually a lot of those issues are universal in terms of financial education and people not protecting their financial information effectively. I'm going to just turn to Rhodora for one last question. And then we've got a few questions in the Q&A, but I encourage others to add to them. I've been told we can go over for a few minutes if folks are interested in continuing the conversation. But Rhodora, can you talk a little bit about how you've applied proportionality to your su supervisory approach, particularly as it relates to natural disasters and to help build the financial resilience of MSMEs in the agriculture sector? You touched on it a little bit before, but maybe just expand on that.
Okay, so the Central Bank of the Philippines applies the principle of proportionality in our supervisory approach to ensure regulatory expectations are commensurate with the size, complexity, and risk profile of our supervised financial institution, so particularly in the context of natural hazards. So while BSP does not directly regulate micro and small medium enterprises, for the agriculture sector, the central bank policies influence these segments through the banking system and financial institutions that serve them. So, how proportionality works in practice? First, we may have simplified forms of compliance for smaller banks. So, because we have a lot of different types of banks in the Philippines. So for the small banks, we have the thrift, the rural, and cooperative banks. So they are the primary conduits of for micro and small medium and enterprise and agriculture credit. So they're not expected to adopt comprehensive frameworks or conduct climate risk stress testing, for instance. They are, however, expected to conduct vulnerability assessment, a simple exercise leveraging on their historical experience or the qualitative information that they receive or gathered from their employees or clients in doing that. So they could do the exercise. And also in the Philippines, we have this free web-based tools which can be explored and used so in conducting the vulnerability assessment. So we have what we call the Hazard Hunter PH. It's an online web-based platform that maps out geospatial information and analyzes the hazards and risks. So through this platform, a bank can get a specific locations, seismic, volcanic, or hydro meteorological hazards. Once you run the once you just encoded the coordinates or the location, then a hazard report will be generated. So some banks are using this as part of their credit risk management, assessing the potential hazard exposure of the location of their clients' business, facility, or collaterals. And some banks are also using this to check the hazard exposure of their branches, or their own physical assets. And another proportionality application is the tailored relief for banks that serve the agriculture sector. So, recognizing the agriculture sector's high exposure to calamities, the regulatory relief policy encourages the banks to grant loan payment deferments of up to 12 months or even longer, depending on the severity of the damage. But in all cases, banks are expected to assess their borrowers carefully, considering, for instance, the actual production cycles, the crop rehabilitation periods, and of course, the borrower's specific circumstances. And the third one is in the form of regulatory incentives. So we have the Agriculture, Fisheries, and Rural Development Act, which was enacted in 2022. So this law recognizes sustainable finance instruments as a form of compliance with the mandatory credit. So linking this to the earlier climate adaptation priority that I mentioned, so we can incentivize banks to extend loans for projects such as climate resilient farming systems, water resource management, or renewable energy for agriculture processing. So this can also be paired with other regulatory incentives that the BSP has implemented, such as the application of zero reserve requirements on the bonds, green bonds, social or sustainability bonds to issued by banks. And I think within the context of natural hazard impact, let me share some practices or some actual cases. For instance, we have use cases from small banks since they are the more affected by super typhoons. There's a one bank that actually adopted a cloud base and it uses satellite internet technology. So by the time that the super typhoon hit their province, actually this bank was able to go online after just how many days because of this adoption of cloud base or the satellite internet technology. And there's also another bank that was affected by some series of typhoons last October, last 2024. It's a blessing, I think, that they have digitized their files because of the, especially the flash floods or the level of floods become too high in their location. So those are just some of the cases that they have shared to us when we were actually developing the regulatory relief policy. So banks, affected banks are sharing their actual experiences and actually some of these measures are some of the relief measures that we have adopted came from banks themselves. So that's how we apply the proportionality principles within the context of natural hazards. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rodora, for that very comprehensive overview. I'm just going to do a couple high level takeaways, but then we can touch on some of the questions that have come in. I mean, one key takeaway for me, certainly from what Leora was saying, is that when we look at financial resilience at the individual level, we certainly see digital driving inclusion, but inclusion is necessary but not sufficient. There's more that needs to happen. And with that expansion, looking at our supervisors and others on the panel, it does seem that your job is getting more and more complex and more expansive. Some of the key themes that came out for me are the importance of leveraging new tools. Mariella, you spoke about AI, and Rodora, you spoke about GIS, incentives, the importance of partnerships and working with those other institutions in country. And then I think as well, certainly making sure, though, that we all take a look at some of the key issues related to trust and trust within the overall financial system and looking at it at those multiple levels. Turning to the questions, I might actually pitch this first one to you, Mariella. Developing financial inclusion in the securities market is very important to democratize access to wealth creation. Is this sector considered in any of the financial inclusion strategies that you have developed?
Yes, actually, there are many participants as part of the policy of the financial inclusion strategies, and we have to coordinate public, private. We consider that a private sector cannot be part of the commission because we consider it's a public tool to develop public policies. However, there are some specific groups where they have a participation because they are the ones that have to give product to high quality of products to people.
Great, thank you for that. Turning to you, Rodora, The role of financial literacy has come up a few times in our conversation, and the focus increasingly on digital financial literacy, and yourself, Mariella, and Lyra all touched on the importance of that digital financial literacy. Can you just speak a little bit to who is responsible for it? And I think one of the perpetual challenges, I know certainly at my organization that we face with is how do you pay for really good financial literacy? Certainly in the case of Peru, working with the education ministry and having it embedded is important, but I'm interested to hear your thoughts on the Philippines.
Well, financial literacy, including digital literacy, is an initiative of each individual financial sector regulator in the Philippines. So we have the BSP for the banking sector, then the Securities and Exchange Commission for the securities market and or capital market, and then the Insurance Commission for the insurance companies. But there is a financial sector forum in the Philippines, which comprise or it's a voluntary body comprising of these three financial regulators, including the Deposit Insurance Corporation. So there's in that financial sector forum, there is a dedicated committee on consumer education and consumer protection and education. So in a way, there's a harmonized and coordinated efforts in extending financial literacy initiatives, including digital ones.
Wonderful. And I think you've actually
Thank
touched
you.
on one of the other questions, which is given the rapid expansion of digital financial services and mobile money and the documented risks related to transaction errors and fraud, what role should financial supervisors play in ensuring that digital financial inclusion advances in parallel with robust consumer protection frameworks? I mean, you touched on that a little bit, but any other comments?
I'll just add, before
Sure.
turning to the regulators, just from the data, we find about one in five adults report sending money to the wrong person using their mobile money account. And in general, no one gets it back, which is a follow-up question. And again, that, it's people losing money. There are some product design features that could pop up the first, additional verification the first time you send to a new number. But there are also some countries in sub-Saharan Africa which you have this, clawback time. And in those countries, people do not report losing the money, which shows that, these sort of efforts can be effective.
Thank you, Lyra. Mariella, anything to add on just consumer protection?
I think probably the most challenging is that we have to understand what people need, and people is a very diverse group. Financial inclusion, when it increase also the heterogeneity of customers, because when we have 20%, they are almost the same. Currently we have gender issues, you have intercultural issues, you have other kind of issues that we have to take into account. That's probably the challenge is try to understand. As financial regulator in the past, it was very simple to coordinate with other financial regulators like the central bank, But currently, when we have to sit with the telco regulator and we have to speak the same language and try to solve a problem that involves both sectors, is very challenging. I can say that probably the coordination mechanism we have to develop in a country are very important, and with and there are not other alternative. We have to work together, and maybe I can say that.
Wonderful. Thank you. I know we've gone over time now, and I'm starting to see some folks drop off. Maybe just one very last question. I'm going to pitch it to you, Liora. What are the gaps in the FinDex country or products that you'd like to see corrected to improve the overall picture? So, next FinDex, what are some of the shifts that you'd like to see?
So yeah, I keep saying we're asking questions about products that hadn't been dreamed up when we started collecting the data in 2011. Certainly, they're more sophisticated digital products and risks that people are using. We'd like to get more around insurance, so that's really, really hard to ask comparably harmonized questions across countries, or even people's perception of insurance is often so different. You really just get a fuller picture of the today's digital risks.
Wonderful. And I think that is a great place to end the conversation. I want to say big, big thank you to my fantastic panelists, Radora in particular. We're going to let you go off to bed now. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your perspective. Mariela, thank you. Muchas gracias. It has been fantastic hearing from what you've been doing in Peru. Liara, we always look forward to the Findex. It's such an important tool for all of us that work in the sector. And a big thank you to colleagues at the Toronto Center. It's so fantastic to have seen so much great interaction. Thank you also to everyone who dialed in. The Toronto Centre does incredible work on engaging with financial sector regulator and supervisors. And a big thank you as well to Global Affairs Canada for joining us and to Barbara for participating on this panel. Prosperity through partnerships is a great theme for the week. And I hope others are able to, there's a lot of International Development Week events happening. So I hope you're able to join more. And with that, I think we're going to draw it to a close. So, big thank you, everybody.